thing that you there. Didn't occur to me.
Yeah, I forgot.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability to order. And committee, we've got a full house almost, and we have some bills to take care of. I do have a major introduction I'd like to do first, and then I'm going to go to House Bill 3629. My intent's to hear that bill and to go ahead and move that bill out. And then we will go down the line, I think, starting from the top. So 3624 is going to come up last. I'm expecting that, I apologize for those of you that came for that and are going to have to sit through a couple other exhilarating topics. Or you can have a cup of coffee or something. I'm expecting about a half an hour per bill. Maybe a little bit, a little bit more on the three public hearing bills, and so I may have to limit the amount of time people have to talk, and if depending on how large the sign-up sheet is. So with that, we need to open a work session for this. And I'd like to open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee measure LC number 235.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move that LC 235, dated February 2nd, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Riley moves that LC 235, dated February 2nd, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Not seeing any discussion. Patrick, could you just tell us what the bill is, just for
absolutely
get it on the record?
Mr. Chair, briefly, LC 235 allows a partnership or joint venture to offer or submit bid to perform construction work if the named partner or joint venture is properly licensed and endorsed for work. This measure would take effect July 1st of this year.
Thank you. And committee, this is a cleanup from a previous bill that inadvertently changed a very important statute that is pretty imperative we take care of, so that's why we have this late introduction. So that covers the discussion that I had. Is there anybody else that cares to discuss that?
What was the bill, Mr. Chair? It was cleaning up.
It was House Bill 3242 from 2007.
Wow. That's pretty good.
I'm seeing they're nodding yes. Okay. It was a bill that came out of this committee and went into Ways and Means, had a lot of changes to it. And anyway, it's a pretty minor. It's basically reverting back to what the law used to be in some fashion or another. So with that, is there any objection to adopting or introducing this as a committee measure? Not seeing any objection, then the measure is introduced as a committee bill. Any other housekeeping things I need to go to?
No, Mr. Chair, I think that
takes care of it. Okay, with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3629. Could you read us a summary of the bill?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3629 specifies the length of term for which a pawnbroker may renew a pledge loan, when a pledger renews a pledge loan, or end the date on which the grace period for redeeming a pledge loan begins. This measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. And in your packet, you will find a no fiscal statement and a no revenue statement on this measure, Mr. Chair.
Looks like we have two people that are going to testify briefly, Paul Romaine and David Tapman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. We, with the assistance of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, drafted what's before you, 3629. It just clarifies, the effect of it is if you pawn an item and you leave it in the pawn shop when you go in to pay it off or pay off something on it or pay off the fees or interest. It's a renewal. If it goes out of the pawn shop, it's a new loan. It just clarifies when something is a new loan and when something is a renewal. And it clarifies that the grace period begins at 30 days after the mailing date rather than delivery date, because you don't know when the delivery date is in something that is mailed. It's a very simple bill. Department's in full support of it. And we want to thank Representative Wingard for helping us get it introduced, and the chair for helping us get the hearing quickly. Be happy to answer any questions.
We go ahead and have Mr. Tapman testify since he's sitting there.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. I'm David Tapman, and members of the committee. I'm David Tapman, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. That's part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Our division is responsible for the oversight and regulation of pawnbrokers in Oregon. And you probably recall last session there was a bill that made some changes to the pawnbroker law. And this is really just a follow-up on that to clarify two minor points. As Mr. Romaine indicated, we talked with the people that he represents and Mr. Romaine at some length, and we feel like this is a good, simple fix to a couple of points they had raised after the session. So with that, as Mr. Romaine indicates, we have no problem with this, and we encourage to see this get passed.
Questions from the committee?
Do we have another 25 minutes to talk, or you said
no.
30 minutes?
Mr. Chair, we hope to move this bill in the next 5 minutes or 25 minutes.
Yes, Representative.
So I just want to make sure that, you know, people have looked at it, make sure there's no unintended consequences. There's no, we're coming out of when it took immense energy to address sort of some of the payday loan stuff. My guess is if I were a person who no longer, like people in my district, frankly, who no longer had a payday loan place on their corner, but do have pawnbroker places within, you know, a few blocks, that might be my other option. I want to make sure that we're not, that in that shift, we are rigorous about standards for that, and your confidence around that obviously provides me some confidence, but want to make sure as we move quickly that we're being smart.
Thank you for that. Is that a question? It isn't. Doesn't seem to be a question, but a comment. But would you like to comment on the comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the question was,
is this going to be terrible or is it going to be great? And I know you think it's great, which is fine enough for me.
It's not great. It's actually just sort of makes things a little clearer.
Yeah.
Pawnbrokers have been around. They're probably the oldest form of lending that's ever existed. They've been around forever. And it's probably the most highly regulated form of lending out there. It's a simple way of lending, and this doesn't really affect the this helps the consumer, basically.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I concur. In fact, this provision, if anything, allows for loans to be made for longer than the 60-day period or renewed for a longer period of time, which I think in many instances is beneficial to the consumer. So everything else, there are a number of safeguards in the law already, and this doesn't touch any of those safeguards for consumers. So I feel confident that consumers will be in no worse shape, and in fact, it will be in fine shape if you make these minor changes.
Great. Thanks very much.
Representative Wingard.
Chair, just want to clarify that point, because the payday lenders are sort of introduced into this, and pawnbrokers make a loan on an actual piece of property, and so it's really not possible for that loan to be extended in perpetuity because the interest would ultimately gobble up the value of the property itself. So there's a natural limitation on this process, and it is, after all, one of the oldest forms of loan out there. It is a property-for-property exchange. It's not a cash advance based on somebody's income, you know, or future paycheck or anything like that.
Helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, thank you for that. But if any of you want to come in and see a pawn shop, they're actually fascinating places to go to. The items that are there are unbelievable. The amount of storage space that goes in. It's not simply you're not storing paper, you're storing items. So if somebody comes in with a big machine, you've got to find a place for that machine and stuff. So it's a fascinating place to go. I highly recommend you go to a pawn shop and take a look at it.
Thank you. Not seeing any other discussion, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3629 and open a work session on House Bill 3629. Representative, entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Wingard.
I would move that the committee pass House Bill 3629 and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wingard moves House Bill 3629 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? And for the record, Patrick, we do have the fiscal and revenue impact statements on this bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So it is ready to go. Any other discussion? Seeing none, it's been my, I guess, custom to have a roll call vote. So, Cindy, would you please give us a roll call vote in any order you like?
Aye.
Representative
Matthews?
Aye.
Representative
Smith? Aye. Representative May? Aye. Representative Wisnett? Aye. Representative Wingard? Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3629, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3629 and open a work session, or excuse me, open a, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3656. Patrick, could you give us a brief summary of the measure before us?
Will do, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3656 stipulates that interest in real property covered by a trust deed is terminated and foreclosed as the person who has given notice on the trustee's sale. It provides that the bar against action for a deficiency applies to the property covered by a trustee, not just property covered by a residential trustee. It eliminates the requirement that debts, if evidenced by note, bond, or other obligation, must be owed to a beneficiary in the residential trustee that was subject to the trustee's sale or foreclosure. We have the measure also has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage. And did you want to speak to the two amendments, or did you?
No, sir. I just for a note, there are a couple of amendments. Committee, a -1 amendment and a -2 amendment. And the -1 amendment has some changes to the effective date of the bill. There's a piece in this bill, or a couple pieces in this bill, that resulted in some unintended consequences from House Bill 3004, which was passed out of this committee last session, but then went to another committee and was changed substantially. And so there were some pieces that needed to be cleared up about the impacts to non-residential trustee sales and a couple other fixes that part of this bill is accomplishing, and it has a implementation date that's a retroactive to clear up that statute. And then there, the anti-deficiency piece has a different effective date, trying to address that. And then I believe the other bill removes, the other amendment is an option to delete the deficiency judgment on the second and just do the cleanup. So I have both of those options before the committee, but we're not acting on, we're not in work session today on this bill and won't be acting on any of the amendments or the bill itself. Wanted to hear the public testimony on the bill.
So, Mr. Chair, it's either or, the amendment one or two. It's not going to be both?
I believe that's correct. I don't think they're compatible. So, but I just got them, so I haven't really had time to, you know, ask a lot of questions about it. So, with that, we have...
One includes two.
It's not either or.
So with that, I'd just like to have the public testimony on the bill. Up first, I have Keith Carnes. Actually, I've got three people, but they're on opposite sides of the bill, so maybe I won't bring them up all together. Welcome, Mr. Carnes. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Representative Polvey and members of the committee. My name is Keith Carnes. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, and I
with the exception of a few small business owners that I represent, I do work exclusively for consumers, and I'm here to urge your support of the House Bill 3656 as drafted. I know we've talked somewhat at length about House Bill 3004 last session, but just as a brief overview, during the Great Depression, it was kind of a policy decision to let mortgage companies either take a person's house or sue them, but not do both. And Oregon adopted that general provision that lenders could do one or the other. With the advent of time, though, we see a lot of mortgages being broken into two separate loans. And the second will always carry a much higher interest rate because there's a higher risk of non-payment. The first mortgage will always have the right to collect against the property, but the second mortgage will have the right to either file a lawsuit or they also have the right to foreclose, but they take subject to the first mortgage themselves. House Bill 3656 eliminates that one of those remedies, which is the right to sue if the borrower fails to make payments and the property is foreclosed. The second mortgage will always have the right to foreclose on the property. They will always have their right to stay in second position on the property, which was the agreement that was originally negotiated between them and the borrower. However, the concern that we often see is that we have scores of people heading into bankruptcy for no other reason than they have now a $30,000 or $50,000 or $80,000 judgment entered against them that they have no hope of paying at all. And the problems that these people face with declining home values and the like just create a real whirlpool that sucks these people under and just buries them in debt that they can never possibly pay. It's my understanding that one of the proposals brings up the concern of the consumer who sells his home to someone else and then holds back a second mortgage. And if the committee were to want to protect those people, certainly you could carve out an exception for prior homeowners to be able to still get a deficiency. However, part of the problem that we have is under House Bill 3004 is it became an easy workaround because when I was speaking to a group of debtor-creditor lawyers, they said this is an easy fix. We just transfer the one mortgage out of our name and that before we foreclose, and then 3004 is defeated. This bill fixes that remedy that they had, which is just to do an end run around, and really 3004 for purposes of protecting consumers against against deficiency judgments is practically worthless for that reason. And so 3656 helps clarify that situation, that part of the problem with 3004 as well as ORS 86.705 says that a beneficiary means the person who was the original beneficiary or their successor in interest, whichever is appropriate. And the part of the problem with 3004 is it didn't say which beneficiary. Was it the original beneficiary or was it the subsequent beneficiary? And so there's ambiguity there. I've heard some people say that 3004 already does what 3656 does, but there's certainly a lot of ambiguity as to how this is done. 3656 places it on the instruments instead of the trustee. 3004 focused on who's the trustee of the foreclosing trust and who's the trustee of the second trust. 3656 puts it on the constraints and time, saying if these two documents are executed within 10 days of each other, then they won't be able to obtain a deficiency. And I think this is an important help. Frankly, I think it will take away some of my business because some folks just won't need to file bankruptcy anymore, and I'm fine with that. But with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Questions of Mr. Carnes? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we still have the 80-20 option? Is that on the books? Is that on the...
Chair Holvey, Representative Wisnett, it's my understanding, and I purchased a home during the time of the worst of the credit freeze, is that they're not doing true 80-20s. They're doing 80-15s or 80-10s and requiring more of a down payment. But this concept is still true, that one lender will lend up to 80% and a second lender will lend some other value, but not usually up to 100% of the home.
Follow-up, I guess, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So none of the protective measures passed federally or state have done away with this, you know, backing up the loan of a second that you can't afford. Is that what you're telling us?
Representative Holvey and Representative Wisnett, that's correct, that no state or federal law has banned the ability for lenders to break these loans into separate first and second mortgages on origination.
Last question, Mr. Chair. Do you have any idea, thank you, Mr. Chair, do you have any idea of how many we're talking about in the state of Oregon?
Representative Holvey, Representative Wisnett, as far as raw numbers, I don't know, but the percentage is going to be well over a third of people who are buying homes are breaking them into two mortgages. I'm sorry, I haven't thought of raw numbers on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify something because you mentioned it briefly, that this doesn't apply to somebody who got a first mortgage and then, because there's a 10-day operative, time frame for the first and second to happen within. Otherwise, the second lien holder would have the ability to sue on the note if it's outside of that 10-day before or after the first, essentially.
Representative Holvey, that's absolutely correct, that the banks and credit unions who give home equity lines of credit where to pay off credit cards or pay off medical bills or something else that's not in the origination will have the right to obtain deficiency judgments as though the trust deed was never in place.
So it is quite a policy, I guess, decision on where we go with this. And so from your perspective, you're speaking in favor of this bill. And I'm just trying to clarify, you know, in my own mind, as maybe for some others, that the policy discussion is really if a lender is making a first and second for the single transaction of a purchase, it seems like a single loan product, and their remedy is foreclosure, and they shouldn't be able to foreclose and also then sue on the note, even though they are two different instruments.
Representative Holvey, that's absolutely correct in that, you know, as I mentioned, this was something that came out of the Great Depression, and now that they've divided them into two loans, it has created this ability to sue on the second mortgage. And it is absolutely a policy decision, but it also helps clarify. 3004 is ambiguous, and I think this would help clarify 3004 and keep the courts from basically creating laws instead of having you do it.
Thank you. Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carnes, I just want to understand the intended fix that I heard you articulate was this idea that a company had originally made both loans and then later on, to circumvent the current law that we passed, they would attempt to change the ownership of one of them so that they could maintain this right to sue. But and today I think I heard you right on that. I guess I'm wondering what would happen, though, if when the loan was originally made, it was two different folks. Maybe it was a large loaning company of some kind, you know, I hesitate to say Countrywide because they don't exist anymore, but, you know, something like that, a large bank, somebody. But the 20 was maybe supplied by a relative or somebody that the person knew personally where they worked out a contract in order to cover that last portion so that they could become a homeowner. Would this change drag that person who offered the 20, the second mortgage, in with the first, because they both have to close together on the sale of that home, so they're going to be within the 10-day window?
Representative Holby, Representative Wingard, you're correct. The most common type of transaction is where the same lender gives the 80 and the 20 from origination, and it does get transferred off. I won't bore you again with my charts and graphs of how that works. I did that last session. The second most common is that a finance company or some other institutional lender will give it a 20, and then sometimes you're correct. In a very small percentage of the cases, a family member or a family trust or a friend or relative will provide the financing for that, and that's inherent within the second mortgage risk, and that's why they're charging, you know, 12 to sometimes 20% interest on these second mortgages. But yes, this would foreclose their ability, I shouldn't use that word, this would eliminate their ability to sue on the second mortgage if the first foreclosed.
Thank you.
That was the same question.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I have another question, but I think I'll wait for another day. So appreciate your testimony. It is an important issue that we're considering, and it does have some pretty serious impacts for sure on both sides of the trustee issue or foreclosure issue. So appreciate that, Mr. Carnes. And next up, Tim Martinez. Tim Martinez. Well, maybe we can have Thomas Behrman come up then.
There's Tim.
Oh, there's Tim.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I understand we're talking about the infamous 80-20 bill, and I did have the opportunity, as some committee members may recall, to testify on this bill. Gosh, was it just last month when you met in the your last interim committee meetings prior to the February session? Our concerns continue to remain the same. We agree with the chair and the logic for a couple of those changes. The first one being the residential change to make sure that's fixed, and then the second, when notice is served. We have no problem with either one of those. We continue to struggle with some of the other amendments that seem to undo what was done in 2004, and I just remind the committee again that the lending community, which would be, you know, the banks, the credit unions, the mortgage brokers, the mortgage bankers, consumer finance folks, spent a lot of time working with the proponents of this bill to try to get something that we could all be satisfied with. We certainly understood it didn't please everybody. Clearly it didn't please the chair, but it was a bill that did pass both chambers and was signed by the governor. And at a minimum, we'd like to give it a chance to see how it's working before we go ahead and make major changes to it. I think if the chair and the committee was comfortable, one of the things I mentioned at my last appearance here was the concern about the language at the same time, what that actually meant. I mean, did it physically mean they had to, you know, sign them or stamp them identical time? And you know, we also realize that is an issue. The bill contemplates putting a time frame, and I think it's been changed. I think it was 30 days originally. Now I believe you've shortened it. We continue to believe that if you were to just simply say as part of the same transaction, which makes it clear that it's, you know, one transaction, may have two loans, but it's one transaction, that would probably satisfy all our concerns. I've not heard back from one member of my committee that I'm still trying to track down, but I'm pretty confident that if we took out at the same time and change it to part of the same transaction, I think we would probably have less difficulty with this piece of legislation.
Question, Mr. Martinez, then, is the part of the same transaction, if that were to fix, you'd be okay with the change to the anti-deficiency piece in the bill?
That's my understanding. I'm now have a note from one of your committee chairs, or excuse me, committee members, and I'm having some language drafted for your review to see if that makes you comfortable as well.
Okay.
But hopefully we can get that back from LC fairly quickly and discuss it and move the bill forward.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing that amendment.
Okay.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martinez, I'm not a lawyer, so I kind of have a problem with, you know, part of the same transaction. I don't quite know how two different loans can be part of the same transaction. That bothers me a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chair, I'm not a lawyer either, so we're both blessed. But I've spent a lot of time talking to lawyers that do this for a living, and it is not uncommon at all that the same closing, when you buy a piece of property with a 100% low, 81st and 22nd, that is indeed the same transaction. That okay. You go and you close it the same as part of the same transaction. So that's okay. All we're trying to do, and I would expect that hopefully Legislative Council can put that down in words that we're all comfortable with.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you, Mr. Martinez, for that, and I'm sure we'll be talking soon.
And I apologize for being tardy out there.
Okay, we just had a whole room of people waiting for you. next up, I have Mr. Barman. And since you're new and perhaps some other people in the audience are as well that may be testifying, it's customary, or it's actually one of our requirements. We'll stop you if you don't. Identify yourself for the record before you start. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, committee members. My name is Tom Barman. I am a real estate attorney. I'm also a member of the executive committee of the real estate and land use section of the Oregon State Bar, resident of the fine city of Bend, Oregon, and here speaking on my own behalf today. Two general issues with respect. I am in favor of House Bill 3656. Two general concepts I want to break out, and I'm sure you guys are familiar with them. One is the fix, and the other is kind of the continuation of this whole idea on the anti-deficiency for the 80-20. So with respect to House Bill 3004, by the time it was passed by the and signed by the governor, that bill unfortunately did more harm than good by changing longstanding rules within the state of Oregon, particularly as it relates to anti-deficiency judgments after non-judicial foreclosures of non-residential trust deeds. And that's something that I've had a lot of members of the bar come to me and express concern about. We have discussion, email discussion boards, and there's been a lot of discussion about that, of what exactly is the effect of House Bill 3004. And so I think the proposed legislation does an exceptional job of cleaning that up, taking us back to where things were before 3004 and clarifying that piece. So I think if for no other reason, the cleanup part of it as kind of an imperative that we be able to move forward to, just so that there is clarity within the law as of today. Second issue is then moving forward on the whole idea of the 80-20s and the anti-deficiency. Although I do not have a specific public policy opinion on the matter, I think that let me first say that the final language that came out of 3004, in my opinion, has absolutely no practical effect whatsoever in terms of changing the rule on anti-deficiencies for those 80-20s. So narrowly defined that I think it would be very hard for us to find a particular example that actually fit within that. So if, in fact, the public policy objective is to provide some protections for homeowners in those situations, 3004, in my mind, doesn't do it. So then the question is, how do you accomplish that? And I think the two pieces that are on the table that you guys are talking about is, one is this whole idea of at the same time, in the same transaction or 10-day window. I think to say at the same time is too narrowly defined. in the same transaction. As a lawyer, I don't like it because it's vague to me, but I think that's better. A 10-day window is something a little bit more concrete that you can look at. You might also, working with legislative counsel, you might also look at things like as part of the same purchase money mortgage transaction to clarify that we are talking about the loans, the funds that were provided for the purchase of that home and not subsequent loans that were taken out to go buy a boat or something else. So that piece, and to me, in my mind, a 10-day window is probably a pretty reasonable, it's wide enough to be able to capture a lot of these transactions in the same transaction. Could probably even be a 5-day window to be able to catch the majority of those transactions, but still sufficiently narrow that you're not accidentally catching some of these follow-on transactions that may not be for the same purchase, for the purchase of the home. The second issue then is whether or not they are the same lender or not. The 3004 language said that it had to be the exact same lender. From my personal experience, very, very, very rarely is the 80 and the 20 made by the exact same lender. In the case of Wells Fargo, even if I went to Wells Fargo and got a loan from Wells Fargo for the 80 and the 20, my 80 would be from Wells Fargo Bank, and my 20 would be from Wells Fargo Home Equity. And they are separate legal entities. So at a minimum, it seems to me that if you want this to have some practical effect, you need to open that up. It may be affiliates. I think the proposal that in 3656 completely throws open the door and removes that language, and it could be a completely unrelated lender. To me, I don't find that change particularly concerning in any respect, and I should clarify, I do not represent consumers. All of my clients are businesses, lenders, or high net worth individuals. I don't regularly represent large financial institutions, although I have on occasion. But within the capacity of my representation, to me, I think that if you put a 10-day window around it, that's enough for me as a lawyer to be able to think about the transaction and structure a transaction that if I specifically want to avoid the effect of this anti-deficiency statute, that I would be able to work within that. So I don't think, Representative Whitson, I got a sense that you were asking whether or not by implementing this we might be chasing a whole bunch of lenders out of our state, and by no means do I expect that would be the case in my personal opinion. So that's all I had to say for today. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Interesting testimony. So it sounds like what you're saying is that you would help provide the people you work for a way to get around this legislation if we passed it this way.
It depends on what exactly Chair Hovely, Representative Tomei, it depends on exactly what it is you're trying to accomplish. So if somebody were walking in for a true traditional 80-20, and the reason why people do the 80-20s is to get around some of the purchase, the insurance requirement. If I have an 80 and a 20, it's all interest, it's all deductible interest expense, whereas if I have, if you go with the more traditional larger loans, they usually required an additional insurance piece. It wasn't a deductible expense. So, that was an aside. If you're trying to do it all as the same transaction and you're buying a house, I'm not sure that you could structure the loan for the purchase of that home around a 10-day window. I think a 10-day window is wide enough, and I haven't really put a lot of thought into it. I think the larger institutions, they're going to fall within that 10-day window. What I'm talking about is specifically like the question that Representative Weingart raised earlier about family and friends, or other types of some of these smaller exception types of things that you might be doing, or if for follow-on loans, let's say that somebody wanted to be able to take advantage of the equity in their house to be able to get cash to go buy a boat or something else. As a general rule, then I would make sure that as the lender on that, if that loan could be postponed, I would want to make sure that loan fell outside the 10-day window.
Follow up. Thank you. I think the intent of the committee, at least the people who are writing the bill, was to protect the consumer so that somebody who has bought a house and has the 80-20, so that after foreclosure, they're still not responsible for that 20. So do you think that this legislation would protect those folks?
Chair Hobley, Representative Tomei, I do believe that they would. When you're dealing with the large national institutions, they have a procedure. They sometimes, it's hard to know for sure how they may change that procedure in the future, but my guess is that they're going to keep enough of a streamlined procedure state to state, and that the criticalness of the timing of those funds coming in to purchase that home, I think it would be very difficult for them for the run-of-the-mill transaction that you're trying to accomplish, that institutional funds, 80-20, for the purchase of a home, I think it would be very hard for them to structure around this. What I was trying to say is that for all of those exceptions that I've heard a couple of different questions around, I think you could in those exceptions, if you weren't one of those institutional lenders, you could work within this rule so that to me this rule provides kind of a nice balance, that it will catch the majority of those transactions, but that if you're in one of those exception categories and you have a little bit lower leniency to be able to work around it, that you can in order to be able to avoid the implication of it. If to me it seems that if you're working around it, that's going to become fairly apparent, and then the consumer in that way becomes more informed as to what's going on.
I think you've raised for me more questions than answers, but thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Representative Matthews.
I just have a quick comment, and thank you for your testimony today. But, you know, as I think back to how this kind of originated, this came to us through a colleague, a constituent, and then it kind of opened the door. And when you think about that situation, that was the testimony came from the mother of somebody who had gotten into an 80-20 loan, and her husband lost his job, and they could no longer afford the house. You know, we're going to have a hard time protecting everybody from everything available that's out there when we have folks that are looking for that opportunity to own the home, and sometimes they have to get creative to get there. I don't think in every case that it's an institution that creates that opportunity and forces people into these. And so I'm really struggling with, are we now, once again, I thought 3004 with the testimony we received, and Mr. Karn is part of that as well, I remember the pie chart well, but I want to say, I thought at the time we were struggling with whether or not we were going to hit a mark, and then we decided that yes, we were, and so we moved that bill forward, and now I'm being told it's ineffective, it doesn't work, and can we get this done? And here we are in February, and I'm just curious if there's going to be enough time for us to actually hit this target, have a piece of legislation that does what we need it to do, and protects people. You know, we have the zero interest, zero day, you know, which, oddly enough, I have zero interest in those loans. But we have a lot of car loans being made available to people, and those cars depreciate the second they're owned. We can't stop that. That's going to continue. So at some point, I just really hope that we are going to hit the mark that we intend to make the target, or we step back and just really realize and analyze whether or not we're being effective. But thank you.
Wasn't a question. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Behrman. I appreciate your testimony and making the trip here to give us your insights into with your knowledge on this issue. So I appreciate that. I do want to say that there are pieces of this bill that will hit the mark, and we do have time to accomplish that. So there are some fixes that need to be done in this bill, and I'm dedicated to getting those pieces done at the bare minimum. So,
Chair Hobley, thank you for your time, and I remain available afterwards if there's questions.
Thank you. No one else is signed up to testify on this bill at this time, so I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3656. And, committee, if we just stand at ease for just a moment. You'd like to bring us back into order. Committee, I am think I'm looking at my agenda, or at least I thought I was looking at it. I think I'm going to go ahead and move to House Bill 3624. There's a tremendous amount of people, I think, here for that bill, and a lot of the people here for 3689 are here pretty consistently. I hope I'm not messing up anybody's schedules. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3624. And Patrick, could you give us a
rundown, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, give us a rundown of the bill, please.
Thank you. House Bill 3624 requires appraisal management companies to register with their appraisal certification and licensure board. It establishes standards for appraisal management companies, prohibits them from attempting to influence appraisals, altering completed appraisal reports, or placing certain requirements on independent contractor appraisers. It directs the board to establish a dispute resolution process and authorizes the board to impose civil penalties on appraisal management companies. It declares an emergency and would take effect upon passage. You have in your packets also the Dash 1 Amendment, which makes a few changes that I believe one of our witnesses will be speaking to.
Thank you. Committee, this is a pretty interesting and yet complex and I think a very important issue for us to consider, and we do have a few people signed up, so I'm just going to have to figure out how many. Okay, just a little bit more than my 30 minutes perhaps, but I think we can manage it. So with that, I'm going to try to limit our testimony to and questions for each individual to 5 minutes. It may be advantageous for us to listen to the testimony, and if you really need to ask a question of somebody specific, go ahead. But I do want to try to get the testimony on the record if I could. So with that, Roxanne Gillespie, please. And did you have someone that wanted to come up with you, or are you fine by yourself? Or
fine by myself. Thank you, Chair Holby.
And I remind you to introduce yourself for the record, please.
I will. Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Roxanne Gillespie. I am a real estate appraiser, president of Gillespie & Associates in Eugene, Oregon. And I want to share with you the great support that real estate appraisers have for House Bill 3624, and to thank Representative Holvey for bringing this legislation for your consideration. My testimony is being passed out. The need for House Bill 3624 has become apparent in Oregon and elsewhere as we've been experiencing constrictions of recent government responses to the collapse of the real estate market. The Home Valuation Code of Conduct, HVCC, is the result of a joint agreement made in March 2008, between Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, and the New York Attorney General. And it's to enhance the independence and accuracy of the appraisal process. It set up a firewall between the lender and the appraiser, leading to greater reliance upon appraisal management companies, AMCs. And their purpose is to manage the appraisal process. However, this code has led to some unforeseen consequences for the purchasers, for property owners, for lenders, for appraisers, and the others that are involved in the lending and the sale of real estate. Since the implementation of HVCC, the majority of appraisal assignments for lending institutions go through an appraisal management company. AMCs are currently the only unregulated, unregistered entity in the real estate valuation chain. Banks, mortgage lenders, title companies, closing companies, real estate agents, and appraisers were all highly regulated either through licensing or registration. For many in the industry, this has been a harsh disruption, and the line of communication has been broken, and that line of communication is between the appraiser and the lenders. There's minimal or no education requirement for AMCs, and the lack of real estate knowledge can have an impact. It's led to poor results for the consumers. I'd like to point out to Chair Holvey and the committee that real estate appraisers have college educations, We have additional education above and beyond our college education to get our license. We also have continuing education in order to maintain our license and our certification, while those in the appraisal management companies are not. More importantly, a number of AMCs have devalued appraisers to the point that many appraisers are leaving the field after deciding that it's no longer a worthwhile career. How does this benefit the purchasers or property owners who are expecting a competent, impartial, and objective and credible appraisal? There are circumstances in which Oregon appraisers have not been paid by AMCs. In addition, appraisers are required to complete appraisals in less than an adequate time, and their compensation level has dropped significantly. At the federal level, Congress has recognized that a problem exists, and House Resolution 1728 passed the House in 2009. It would require states to register, regulate appraisal management companies in the public interest. Included among unfair and deceptive practices is, quote, withholding or threatening to withhold timely payment for an appraisal report or for the appraisal services rendered, as well as many other provisions. Real estate appraisers work from comparables, which are comparisons of similar houses, similar properties that have recently sold in the surrounding neighborhoods. Frequently, an AMC will select an appraiser based on the lowest bid rather than on the experience for certain types of property or geographic knowledge. Secondly, an AMC may require reduced turnaround time, which adversely affects the ability to accurately research and verify the data necessary for the comparables. This can mean appraisals received by lenders are not the most accurate. They could have financial ramifications for the consumer. Thirdly, real estate agents must shoulder extra burdens in working with the appraisers who are not familiar with the area. House Bill 3624 requires appraisal management companies to register with the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board and establishes a standard for appraisal management companies practicing in Oregon. Six states have already passed this legislation: Arkansas, California, Louisiana, Nevada, New Mexico, and Utah. Arizona, Colorado, North Carolina, Florida, and Washington are in the process. We strongly urge the committee to carefully consider this bill and vote yes on House Bill 3624, and I truly do appreciate your attention and time to this matter. Any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Gillespie. I just have one question that I know the answer to, but I want the committee to know that the language primarily in this bill is modeled after something that has been worked on by appraisers and associations for a while. I just wonder if you could briefly describe that for us.
That is correct, Chair Hovey and committee members. The AMC legislation that is being brought forward by Chair Hovey is based on the AMC model legislation put out from the, I believe it's from the Appraisal Institute and their Washington, D.C. office. And it's available online if you'd like to take a look at it. It is available. And the bill 3624 is modeled after that language.
Thank you. Questions?
Just to follow up to your question. So who else was the stakeholders besides appraisers in this language?
Chair Hovey, Representative Matthews. Who else are the stakeholders in this? On the website, I believe it is the International Right-of-Way Associations, other appraisers there. You said other appraisers, people other than the appraisers, correct?
Specifically that crafted the language that we're looking at as being used by other entities.
I believe real estate agents have been involved in this. They looked at it. I believe that there are title companies that have looked at it. I would have to double-check for you, Representative Matthews.
Thank you. And I can probably get that from Ms. Butterfield. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and I'd like to move on to the next.
Thank you
very much. I think I'm going to John Barrett and Carl Royer, if you don't have a problem coming up together. I don't know if you know each other, but... So I appreciate you coming, and normally I appreciate the written testimony, and it's very important, and but I'm going to ask you not to read us your entire testimony since we have it in writing to, you know, make sure we have enough time to get through all the testimony today. So if you could summarize what you've written or add to some pieces, I know that might be a little bit of a challenge for you, but you know, hit the high points or something, I would appreciate that. So if you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is John Barnett, president of Barnett Valuations in Florence, and I just want to obviously show my support for the House bill. You know, obviously you do have my written testimony in front of you. I am a business owner. I've been an appraiser for numerous years. I am a husband, a father of five. You know, and there's been a significant impact in my business. And in 2009, I went ahead and calculated what I had lost. Obviously, there had been an economic change. You know, with that being aside, with the impact of the AMCs and the differences in the fees that we're able to collect now, I've lost, give or take a few percent, right around 40% of my income with the impact of appraisal management companies. There has been numerous occasions where we get bid emails from appraisal management companies wanting us to bid on potential work with them not caring of the complexities, the geographical competency of the appraiser. They don't care if I would have to travel across the state. They are interested in the bottom line of how inexpensive that they can get the appraisal product. And I've got numerous concerns with this. I'm seeing situations where I'm not getting paid from AMCs. I'm seeing situations where it's taking 90 to 180 days to get paid, where before we had an open line of communication between lenders that we most oftentimes, there's always exceptions to the rule, that we got paid within a 30 days or at least a timely process. I'm seeing situations where AMCs are requiring undue turn times with that's not allowing us to be able to do the proper comparable research, that's not allowing us to be able to do the job, the assignment that we need to be able to do, just so they can make claims, such as I have one right here, that there's one company that spoke with me that they claim to have the fastest turn times in the business. And they are particularly worried about pushing appraisals through, getting them done for the cheapest they possibly can. And with that, I dare to say that there's going to be sacrifices involved with that. You know, you have my written testimony. You know, in conclusion, under the situation, I'm considering leaving the appraisal profession. You know, I'm an appraiser. I own my own business. I'm a husband, a father of five, and this is a pretty big impact for me. So I thank you, Chairman, representatives. Thank you for listening to me. If you have any questions.
If you'd like to go ahead and give us your testimony and state your name for the record, please.
The name is Carl Royer. I'm a licensed appraiser, Oregon and Washington. I'm the current chair or the current president of the Portland Rose City chapter of the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers. And you've gotten the background for the AMCs, so I'm not going to address that. I'm just going to attempt to very briefly emphasize the need for this bill. And why we must have this bill, because As you've already heard, the MCs are the only ones in the lineup of professionals that don't have to be regulated or licensed. And by being licensed, the AMCs would be making a commitment to be responsible to all parties concerned, and that with special emphasis on who we're all looking out for here, that's the consumer. And that would include a financial commitment. I'm not going to get into parts of the bill or talk about that. The financial commitment is to protect the consumers by full disclosure, including where the money goes, disclosing where the money goes. And I've had reports and read articles that about 50% of the time the AMCs still attempt to influence appraisal results. So they would be making a commitment that their methodology for getting appraisals done would allow us to report unethical behavior. They would be making a commitment in that manner for ethics. And creating and maintaining and raising standards for AMCs would protect consumers, as you've already heard. Appraisers have standards that they have to go by and standards that they need to get their license. And that should be applied to AMCs also to protect consumers. And we believe the bill will help in that direction. And my opinion is that the AMC bill should be administered by the ACLB because it's familiar with the appraisal practices. And a large majority, well, I won't say that. I'd say a significant amount, if not a majority, of the appraisals managed by AMCs are done by AMCs that are owned by banks. And so having the AMCs administered by the same departments that administer the banks could be a conflict. And that's all I had. I'll leave the rest of it up to people more knowledgeable and eloquent than myself. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and I think you spoke quite clearly. Representative Wingard, a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barnett, Mr. Ryer, just a basic question. This settlement agreement created the AMCs, and I'd like the two of you to give me your professional opinion about whether you think the creation of AMCs actually improved this system for consumers.
Well, my personal opinion is it did some good in that it created a firewall between the appraiser and the quite demanding customer of ours, the banks or the loan brokers, that try to influence banks and loan brokers both can try to influence the results of an appraisal. But I think the unintended consequences are that, well, I'll give you an example. I used to get, until they finally got tired of sending them to me, because I never accepted any, requests to do appraisals, turnaround time 24 hours from the time they sent the order, and the fee was $125. My typical fee is in excess of, quite a bit in excess of that. Most appraisers are. I can't work under those circumstances. If I have one job already ahead of me, there's no possible way I can get that job done. And the unintended consequences are that now the AMCs are using the least qualified appraisers. So,
Representative, would have to concur with everything he said. I would have to add an additional impact that I have seen to the consumer is substantially higher fees for the final appraisal product. I have a close friend of mine who purchased a single-family lot, quarter acre, in a subdivision. Normal fee of that is would be somewhere between the $300 to $400, depending on the market you're in. That may vary some. But when she actually got to the closing table, the appraisal fee on that, the markup, changed it to over $600 for that particular fee. I ran into numerous situations dealing with FHA appraisal products where a borrower will decide to change lenders in midstream and the AMC will not allow the appraisal product, which under Fannie Mae guidelines can be changed from one end lending institution to another, will not allow that appraisal product to change hands, so the consumer is forced to pay for an additional appraisal product issued through a different AMC. So there's been substantial damage. Granted, there has been significant protection creating that buffer between the lender and ourselves or mortgage brokers when there were situations of undue pressure, things of that nature, but there has been some significant unforeseen negative impact also.
Thank you. I appreciate the question and the answers. Just got one quick one. So you're talking about that undue pressure. Is there any buffer zone between the lender in regards to that undue pressure between the lender and the AMC?
None that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
And
yes.
The AMC came about originally because Washington Mutual and their AMC were colluding, and Washington Mutual put pressure on the AMC until it agreed to use those particular appraisers that that would come in, do whatever Washington Mutual wanted, come into value or whatever, leave off repairs, whatever the situation was. And that situation hasn't changed.
Yeah. Thank you. That was a point I was looking for. I appreciate your testimony. I need to move on to get some other testimony on the record and give everybody a chance to speak. Next up, I have Bob Keith and John Larson.
Hello, Representative Holby. My name is Bob Keith.
Welcome.
And, may I have a key member of my staff join me in case you guys ask me a hard question that I could have her answer it?
Absolutely.
Karen Turnbow will come up and join me. Thank you, Karen.
And I believe John Larson submit us a written testimony? I believe. No, anyway, well,
Mr. Chair, I'll explain his absence. A little bit about me. I'm a career appraiser. It's the only thing I've ever done is be a real estate appraiser until about 9 years ago. I became the administrator of this board. And during that time period prior to being an administrator, I was a board member. And so I have a pretty good insight into both the regulatory aspect of real estate appraisal as well as appraisal itself. I'm pretty familiar with HVCC and a little bit familiar with this bill, and I hope to make a small few corrections about some testimony that was given earlier today to make sure that we're all on the same page and have the accurate information. Our board is comprised of five real estate appraisers, one board member, and there's one banker member who's the vice chair of our board, John Larson. Our board is in unanimous support of this bill. I'm sorry that our board chair, Craig Zell, cannot be here today. I encouraged him not to come, as a matter of fact, when he told me that he had strep throat. And so he's not here. Our vice chair, John Larson, as I said, is our banker member, came and was here earlier and intended to testify, but I'm sorry to report that for certain reasons he's not able to stay here and testify. The home valuation code.
Mr. Keith, we're debating on whether you actually identify yourself, so if you could do it.
Oh, I did. Yeah, Bob Keith.
Thank you.
Very personal.
Who's the executive director of?
And I am the administrator of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's true. The Home Valuation Code of Conduct was set up to create a firewall between those who order appraisals that get paid a commission if a loan closes, such as mortgage brokers, loan officers, and people of that nature, and the appraisers are supposed to be independent, objective, and unbiased. And so prior to HBCC, with the subprime mortgage meltdown and the subsequent collapse virtually of real estate markets, this agreement came into being, and it's not really a law or regulation. It's an agreement that anybody who wants to sell loans to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, the secondary mortgage market, has to order appraisals according to this guideline. And this is the firewall that's set up to preserve appraisers' independence. HBCC prohibits, again, this is for loans that are going to be sold to the secondary market, it prohibits mortgage loan officers from ordering appraisals, or anyone that's going to be paid a commission if the loan closes from ordering appraisals. HBCC, as a matter of fact, did not create appraisal management companies. They've been in existence for probably three decades. However, once the Home Valuation Code of Conduct went into effect in May of last year, appraisal management companies proliferated because it was much easier for lenders to subcontract out the appraisal management process, than, for example, one national lender trying to maintain lists of appraisers throughout the entire country. So the result is now the vast majority of appraisals, perhaps I'd estimate 60% residential appraisals, are ordered by appraisal management companies. So you have real estate appraisers now who maybe used to have 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 mortgage broker clients now have maybe 2 or 3 or 4 appraisal management companies. So when you hear appraisers who were just before me and talk about the pressure that they feel to do things like fast turnaround times and cut corners in order to get jobs done on time for low fees, appraisers feel like they're economic hostages, like they don't really have a choice. It doesn't give them an excuse to do a bad appraisal work, and when they do, then that's when our agency steps in, because that's not permissible. But it doesn't negate the fact that there is economic hardship that these appraisers are feeling. I hear, my staff hears, if not daily, then definitely weekly, complaints from appraisers about appraisal management companies, and I won't reiterate them now because you've heard all of them, except you haven't heard how appraisal management companies want appraisers to give them their digital signature, and they want the appraisers to sign indemnification clauses and hold harmless agreements. Appraisal management companies have staff that are not knowledgeable about appraisers, and they ask appraisers to do things which are in violation of the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. I hear these comments. My staff hears them on a routine basis. We hear from irate homeowners, borrowers, consumers, because who, by the way, in most cases do not even know that an appraisal management company is even involved with their deal. They complain about poor quality appraisals, and appraisers that come from Portland to do appraisals in Eugene and not familiar with the area. And again, this has been touched on earlier. One thing that consumers are really ticked off about is that they're kind of caught in a crossfire. They can't go to the appraiser and talk to the appraiser about maybe comp selection or about a value conclusion. Well, because the uniform standards that we enforce at our agency would preclude an appraiser from doing that. Okay, the Home Valuation Code of Conduct. Hold on. Let me just pick up from this point and go forward. Consumers feel frustrated and powerless because they don't have a place to go. They call the appraiser says, I can't speak to you. The appraiser says, call the appraisal management company. So the appraisal management company says, I can't talk to you, call the lender. They call the lender. You see what I'm saying? There's no way for a consumer to have a concise resolution process if they want to challenge something. Okay, that's one of the things that this bill provides for. This bill, House Bill 2624, is similar to many other states. It provides safeguards and protection for consumers, and more importantly, it provides accountability for appraisal management companies by requiring them to identify some key person or controlling person within that entity. That person has to have a background check. There's a security bond. There are record-keeping requirements for AMCs. There's an audit procedure that our board would be able to audit AMCs to ensure that they are fostering appraiser independence. This bill prohibits, by law, any attempted influence on appraisers, value conclusions, or opinions. It prohibits removing the appraiser's signature from a report or altering appraisal reports. It requires timely payment. Most importantly, it provides enforcement capability for AMCs. And perhaps even the most important thing is it requires in Section 9 of the -1 amendments to this bill that the board would adopt rules to require appraisal management companies to have a dispute resolution process, and that would be fleshed out in administrative rules through that public hearings process. And so one thing that House Bill 2624 does not do, it does not provide comfort to a group of unregulated entities, AMCs. It does not provide any comfort to powerful interest groups who have an interest in not seeing this bill go forward, okay? It doesn't provide comfort to them. In conclusion, I would say that the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board is in unanimous support and urges you for a due pass recommendation onto the House floor. I thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions that you may have.
So, committee, I'm running a bit behind schedule. I will allow a question if someone has. I think he laid out a pretty good testimony. And if there isn't one, I just have one. And I guess it's more of a question about the good aspect of the AMC providing that buffer to prevent the appraiser from undue pressure and accommodating a lender and producing a valuation to make a deal happen, which they make commissions on. Do appraisers aren't appraisers currently restricted from, or is that actually against the standards and practices of appraisals right now under your authority to submit to that kind of pressure?
Absolutely, and we when we catch them, we take care of it. Right. There's a lot of it that's going out there that we're not we're just not in a position to know about. And as I mentioned earlier, it doesn't make it right for appraisers to do the wrong thing, to do poor quality work in order to make the work product fit the fee. That's not right.
Right. So to follow up on my question then, so for an appraisal management company to say, well, you know, we want, you know, this appraisal to come in at $200 instead of $400, and if you don't do that, you're just not going to work. And so an ethical appraiser would say, well, I guess I can't do the work.
Well, there's two things going on there.
Or is that requirement applied to the...
There's two things. On the one hand, if you say that the appraisal management company says, I'll give you the job if you can get $400 for me on the property value, and if the appraiser says yes, and we find out about it, they won't have a license. The second thing that's going on is on the front end of that, when the assignment comes in and the appraiser says, well, my normal fee is $400. The appraisal management company says, too bad. We only pay $200. Now it's a business decision for the appraiser to decide whether to work for half the fee or not. But it's not unethical if they cut their fees to eat.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you. I'll be brief, Mr. Chair. Bob, it's my understanding that not all lenders use AMCs and that there is an alternative option for them under these.
As I mentioned in my testimony, Representative Wingard, Chair Hovey, you're right. Yeah. Only those loans that are going to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac have to be ordered according to the HBCC, which does not require that AMCs be used. There is a process and a mechanism and a procedure that a lender, by separating their loan production side from their administrative or finance or some other side, they can order appraisals directly from appraisers, just not from the loan production side.
Thank you for clarifying.
And then furthermore, any non-secondary market-bound loan, mortgage brokers, lenders, or whoever can go straight to an appraiser just like they always used to and order the appraisal. It's only prohibited if that loan is going to be headed for the secondary market.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and I've got Diane Forsberg up next.
Thank you.
no Diane Forsberg, which might help me get back on schedule. Next, I have Tim Martinez and Sean Jillians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'll try and get you back off schedule if I can, Mr. Chair. I think we've heard a lot today about the problems with the HVCC and kind of the unintended consequences that have been a part of it. I just wanted to give you all a brief little synopsis of what our national association is doing, because we are quite concerned with the rise of AMCs and what's happened. At the national level, we have had numerous discussions with Attorney General Cuomo of New York to try and get him to back off of some of the requirements that he put in place. Today, we have not been successful with that, but we do keep the dialogue open. In addition, we introduced a bill in Congress to put an 18-month moratorium on the HVCC. We have 180 members of Congress signed on to that bill because there have been a lot of unintended consequences from what we thought was a pretty good idea of putting a firewall in between lenders and appraisers. I think you've heard a lot of stories that cause a lot of concern for the end consumer with AMCs and what's been occurring with them. And at the outset, I would say, as the Oregon Association of Realtors, we're very concerned about what has occurred with AMCs and the problems that appraisers have had, more importantly, the problems that consumers have seen in the end. We certainly feel like registration is necessary for these entities, and we also feel like regulation is necessary for these entities. But my initial comment there was about the HVCC and the unintended consequences, and we are worried about rushing a bill through that it might have unintended consequences. This is an extremely complex issue, but again, I reiterate, we are committed to making sure that they are registered and regulated in the state. We're not quite certain that the model language is the end-all, be-all, and the state of Washington had something that was quite different approach. I think, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to work with you and any other committee members to thoroughly dig into this issue and come up with language that would solve everyone's problems on this issue. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Martinez.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You notice I stayed in my seat, did not leave. Here we have the Oregon Bankers Association, and once again on behalf of the United Financial Lobby. I guess I missed a meeting because I get to do the United Financial Lobby testimony today as well. And just a reminder again.
And you are?
Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. They are, the United Financial Lobby again is credit unions, banks, mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, consumer finance folks. We are certainly of the opinion that there needs to be a bill in this area. Our concern is, can we get it done in a week or 2 weeks, however long we're going to be here, or however long your committee is going to be open. We have talked to the realtors. We have talked to the folks now representing the appraisers and stand committed under your leadership or however you decide should do that to work on this issue. I know there is a desire to do it in this session. 20 years ago when I started in this business, I didn't think I'd be here 20 years later reminding something that happened 20 years ago. But in 1990, when I first started, was when Congress passed FIREA, which started the whole licensing process and the appraisal boards around the country. And Oregon passed it in 1991, I believe, and Mr. Keith was involved with that back in that time frame. We spent months as we prepared that legislation to make sure we did get it right and to make sure there wasn't any unintended consequences. And that's our major concern here. We're not saying, I'm not here today on behalf of the bankers or the UFL saying that there isn't a need for legislation. What we're saying is there's a need for good legislation and to make sure we have that time to work on that. So we stand committed to do that. If the committee in its wisdom and the legislature in its wisdom, collective wisdom, decides that you need to do something right now, I have shared some potential language with Sean as well as with the folks representing the appraisers. It's basically a registration piece so that we can at least get a handle on who's in the state. I mean, clearly nobody knows who's all out there right now, and that certainly wouldn't be bad information to have.
But I would also say that in this language that we would be prepared to accept, if I may read briefly, there would be a section dealing with appraiser independence. And it would say that it would be unlawful for any employee, director, officer, or agent of an appraisal management company registered in this state pursuant to this chapter to influence or attempt to influence the development, reporting, or review of an appraisal through coercion, extortion, collusion, compensation, inducement, intimidation, bribery, or in any other manner, including but not limited to withholding or threatening to withhold timely payment, withholding or threatening to withhold future business or demotion or termination or threatening to demote or terminate. Expressly or implied promising future business promotions or increased compensation. That's just a couple. There are about 8 or 9 or 10 items on there. So, you know, we agree. Have there been problems in the past? Yes. Can we put the genie back in the bottle? Part of that, as Sean mentioned, is what happens at Congress. You know, there's a fair to good chance that Congress will deal with this issue in the next 3 or 4 months. Certainly the House, in their version of financial regulation, has included some language in this area, and we don't know what the Senate's going to do. What I'm told, and I don't know what Sean's hearing from his folks, but what I'm told is there is indeed a good chance that the Congress will step in here and try to undo some of these problems. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and if I could just leave you with one item. We are not here opposing the registration of these folks, but we would like to be part of a broader work group and try to come up with something that everybody is comfortable with.
Thank you for that, Mr. Martinez. I appreciate your caution and your sentiments on this. I also, also understand that I don't know who's going in your proposal going to regulate this. I have had conversations as late as this afternoon about this, and frankly, there is a concern about moving forward with solely a registration piece amongst every agency that I've talked to that's being considered under this, with just a sole piece of registration, because it becomes without some sort of standards involved in that. And I'm glad that there's appears to be at least some in there, because just a license becomes a good housekeeping seal to operate in the state of Oregon without any kind of standards or requirements or ethics or rules attached to it. So I do have some concern about it being too narrow of just registering and licensing. So that, having said that, I'm sure I will work to have a conversation offline with all of you on this. I will note, though, that I do know that the appraisers have been working on this issue for a year at least, and they do have a banker on their board, and they have also included a stakeholder group that involves an AMC in the draft of this legislation. That's what I've been told, is at least. And so I know it's been happening somewhat quickly in many people's eyes, but there has been a considerable amount of time and effort and participation in trying to come up with this under the Appraiser and Licensure Board, trying to put together some stakeholders to look at this issue. So I know the realtors and the bankers share a great deal of interest in this topic, and certainly want to include you in whatever legislation we pass, that I commit that we will continue to work on this into next year and into next a session, and see what happens at the federal government. But regardless of what happens at the federal government, I think it's incumbent upon the state of Oregon to make sure that we have some sort of idea of what we're doing and have the authority to regulate this industry. I do not want to sit back and not regulate this at this point in time, because the appraisal industry itself, I think, is at risk of disappearing. And I don't think that would be good for any of us. So,
I would agree 100%, Mr. Chair. The one thing I would comment about what particular agency or agencies going forward, in my head, if a work group went forward, we would be working to develop legislation that would clearly outline what the regulations would be. And so we could see a lot of what the agency would actually have to hold these particular AMCs accountable for. So
thank
I would
you.
Just add that.
Thank you.
And I would, if I could, Mr. Chairman, also add, and thank you for reminding me,
We have not taken a formal position on the location, but I will tell you that it probably is problematic that we would support, and I think I can speak for the members of UFL as well, that we would support this being under the appraisal board. I know when I testified earlier or last month again on this topic, that at that point it looked like Washington perhaps wasn't going to do anything this session, and I believe six states have gone down this road and about 20 are looking at legislation in 2010. Most of those obviously meet annually and are not in for a quick period of time. But Washington has moved a bill from one chamber to another just to keep the discussion going, and obviously they meet for 2 months instead of one. But their bill, as passed by one chamber, would put it under their DFCAS, under the DCBS, as opposed to the appraisal board. And again, I think just to follow up on what Sean said, it is going to take some time to figure out what the sideboards are. And what the what the do's and don'ts are, and I just struggle to see how we can do that in the time frame that you have to do this bill or any bill this session. And again, we just encourage you to look at the registration as a way to get a handle who's out there. Lastly, as far as the appraisal board, you're right, there is the banker on that board. I talked to him before November, December, and at that point they. At least the impression I got was that they were looking towards a 2011 bill and that the work group was going to be expanded. I'm not here representing the AMCs, but as I understand it, 80% of the market is owned by three of them. As I'm told, none of those folks were involved in these discussions. So I commend them for starting that discussion, but the group was not very, very broad that was involved in that.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. I don't see any other further questions, and I'm running a little bit behind schedule.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention that there were three individuals who submitted testimony that couldn't, that did not speak. Those would be Michael Reed from Kaiser, Rodney Hess from Gresham, and Laura Adkins and Norman Myers representing Pacific Coast Appraisals.
Mr. Chair, real quick. It's been testified today, thank you, Mr. Chair, that a lot of the appraisers feel like having to respond real quick. What in your two business arenas would force people? I didn't think the rush. There shouldn't be a rush now. There's not a lot out there. Why would your people be giving them such a short suspense? Or people you work with?
Mr. Chairman, I don't really have a good answer for that. I've not talked to my lenders where they indicate that they're looking for a 24-hour turnaround. So that information is new to me. I will say that it is listening to some of those appraisers testify. It is a shame what's happened in the real estate market. But I would also point out that my association is four or five members smaller now because of banks that are no longer in existence in this state. There were 16,000 mortgage brokers at the height of the real estate boom. There's about 9,000 now. So, yes, appraisers have gone out of business and their income has been cut, but everybody that's involved in the real estate industry has faced the same kind of drastic reductions.
Mr. Chair, is this our last?
We have one more bill after this.
Is this our last panel on this bill?
It is.
Can I make just one brief comment for the record?
Representative,
appreciate the desire to get it right. I've been thinking about it in advance of this hearing, and I would just say to my fellow committee members, it seems like we'd have three choices. One is to do nothing and wait. Right, and sometimes waiting means actually doing something, and I fear that sometimes it means not. Second, to go fast and get it all done. And a third would be, part now, part later, do what we are confident about now and, fix it in post or do the things we're confident about, delay implementation, and then get something done in the meantime. And I think we might want to consider option three of getting something done.
Thank you, Representative Smith. As you all know, legislation and law is a dynamic process, and what we do oftentimes we come back and tinker with again, and I think that's just a state of the process at hand. Things change, and We never get it right the first time, usually. Every once in a while we do, but my experience is that we come back and we do fix bills from time to time, and hopefully we don't cause too much damage in the meantime, which I'm sure is one of your concerns. So appreciate that. Appreciate the testimony. Thank you, committee members, for your patience.
Thank you.
And with that, we've finished that. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3624. And just briefly, do I forgot to assign our first bill carrier. Do I need to open a work session to do that? Representative Wingard, would you like to carry that bill you sponsored on Palm River?
Please, Mr. Chair, thank you.
You shall be the man. Thank you. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on... This one's next. House Bill 3689. Is there anybody left?
I think they're in there.
Next up, we have.
That's a question I've got.
Yeah.
I do.
It's an important issue. And while you're standing, you might as well come up. I know Scott Berry signed up first, but I think I'd rather hear from Jeremy and Craig. Would you mind joining him?
I hope he remembers that.
Just to help us explain the bill real briefly, and well, we've got a little bit of time. And. Thank you very much for the work that you have put into this, and perhaps a little bit broader of a work group scenario. But I know the last parts of the amendments have come through hours and hours of diligence on a lot of people's part, including your own. So thank you for that.
My pleasure, Mr.
Chairman. You would introduce yourself for the record,
certainly.
Please.
Jeremy Vermilia, Tigard, Oregon. I'm an attorney, construction lawyer, sit on the Oregon State Bar Construction Law Steering Committee. I think that's what we're called. I also am, in addition to that, at the Council of the Board of Directors of the Associated Contractors, although I'm not representing them in that capacity. I'm pretty familiar with construction. That's my primary focus in my practice, and that's how I came to be involved in this in this piece of legislation. And I want to thank you for your willingness to be open to hearing other points of view over the course of the last year or so since this issue first came up. And I think we've made a lot of progress in getting to working on a piece of legislation that gets to the issues that you and other members of the committee have been concerned about while still preserving the lien process that's been in place in Oregon for the last 150 years. And I think, you know, these are minor changes to the law on their face, but I think they really go towards the kind of consumer protection that we're all trying to accomplish here. And so I want to thank you for allowing that process to take place. Would you like me to kind of go a little bit over
the maybe if you
substance?
Could just get yep. the main parts of the bill for us?
Certainly.
What you think you can accomplish in about 5 minutes?
I can probably get it done in less than that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you may or may not recall that I was here a few weeks ago to talk about Legislative Concept 139, which is now House Bill 3689. I'm not going to get into great detail in terms of what the bill does, because I covered that in my last testimony and through a written memorandum that I submitted. Since we were here last, there have been some amendments to the bill, and I want to go over those. Just real briefly, the bill basically does four things. It eliminates the ability of home sellers to waive their obligations under ORS 87007, thereby requiring them to provide something like an early issue title insurance to prevent post-closing liens from being filed, or better put, allow for insurance to cover such liens if they are recorded after a sale goes through. Second thing the bill does is require downstream contracting parties to check the license status of the party with whom they are contracting, and it eliminates the downstream party's lien rights if they supply labor, materials, or equipment to a party that they know or should have known was unlicensed at the time the contract was entered into on residential remodels. Third thing it does is it standardizes lien release forms so that across the board in Oregon, everybody will work off the same four forms that are in the bill, and thereby will get us to a point where we have a standard set of rules. We'll be able to develop some case law around the interpretation of the forms, and I think it will clean up the release process and over time result in less litigation over what you released and what you didn't release. And finally, provide some limitations on the amount of upfront deposits a remodeling contractor can get from an owner to try to protect against, you know, the proverbial, you know, pickup truck guy walking down the street, knocking on doors, taking 50% deposits, and then never showing up to do the work. We've worked on a few amendments, mostly technical amendments, that cleaned up some of the language. That's in the dash one. Spent a lot of time working with the CCB, Kathleen Dolan, who was here. I don't think she's here right now, but she was very helpful in drafting the technical changes. That basically, I think we have a bill now that is pretty dialed in to what the intent of the work groups that have worked on this were. I understand that there's another amendment sort of out there in the works, and that would change the provisions related to the amount of deposit and move it from a statutory mandate to a provision whereby the CCB would write rules and could use that as a tool in the event that a contractor had an enforcement action brought against them. Either of those two concepts works fine in my view. I think the real question is really a policy one, and that is it something we want to require of the industry as a whole, or is it something we want to allow the CCB to use as an enforcement mechanism so that if a contractor has demonstrated a pattern of inappropriate behavior, they then have to have these restrictions imposed upon them so they can't, you know, charge more than a certain percentage or something like that. I'll leave it to others to decide which is the correct policy. I think there are some benefits to going the route that the home builders are going to suggest because, for example, if you have a product that is specified in an original contract and then the homeowner wants to buy the upgraded material or component or whatever, by virtue of the deposit rules that are in here, you may create delay in the project or create, you know, additional costs that were unintended at the time of the contract. So there is some probable benefit to going down the other route. The only other thing I'll talk about right now, I want to testify about Section 9 in the bill and 10 also, and that has to do with retainage. In the original concept that the work group went through, we had talked about limiting requiring retainage to be withheld from contractors' payments. And there are amendments in Section 9 and 10 to the existing law that relate to retainage, and those amendments were made basically as part of the form and function mandate that Ledge Council has. The original concept did include some changes related to retainage. Those have now come out in the course of the work sessions. I want to make it clear that there's no intent to change any existing law or practice. These modifications really should be considered style changes only, and frankly, I think the committee ought to seriously consider just simply removing Sections 9 and 10 since we're not really making any other changes. But I'll leave that to your discretion, but I wanted to make it clear that there is no intent to change the substantive law with respect to retainage as it currently exists. And that's that will conclude my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you or the committee might have.
So, Jeremy, real quick on that retainage piece, you know, I mean, the proposal that we put out, we pulled back because of our work group. You know, that was one of the things we conceded, said, okay, we're going to get rid of that one. It's not going to work. So those changes to that retainage piece that Legislative Council done is something that they're somewhat, you know, they have these mandates of plain language, and when they do statutes, they try to clean up. And we did go back and try to limit substantially the amount of cleanup that they were trying to do to try to prevent any unforeseen, unintended changes in the law. So are you saying that the changes they made in Sections 9 and 10 may actually change the law,
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that they change the law substantively. I believe that what they're doing is there's some changing things from passive voice to active voice, things of that nature. So I don't believe that they change the substance of the law, but I do think it's important to make clear for the purpose of legislative history that there is no intent to change the substance, that the intent is that the current practice, which is that you may retain 5%, up to 5% if there is a payment bond in place, and you may retain more than that if the parties agree to by contract, that ought to remain as is in current law, and that these technical changes based on form and function mandates should not change the substantive law as it currently is.
Thank you for that, Claire, and that's certainly the intent of the chair as well. So, Craig.
Chair Holvey.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. You have before you a summary of kind of an outline of the bill as it was originally written. I would echo all the comments that Jeremy has made, and he said them better than I could. I think it's worthy to note that it was, I think, the spring of last year at about this hour when we talked about this matter before, and we went down a path that didn't work out. But I guess I just want to give credit to this committee and credit to the chair to hang tough. I think this is a worthy policy debate. These several things, working on the Home Buyer Protection Act, tightening that up, making it so subs and suppliers when a sub is not licensed, doesn't have a lien right, and also putting those statutory those lien waivers in statute, those three things are worthy of your consideration. I think that they're going to make Oregon a better place, and if you choose to pass them, although CCB doesn't have a lot of involvement with those particular laws, I think that you're going to help the construction industry.
So, Craig, I got one quick question before I call up a few others to talk briefly. I know that the home builders have a different proposal on the down payment piece. Originally we proposed, I think it was 25%, and had this tiered thing, and I moved it up to 50% for under 100,000, and then 50,000 or 50% of above that or something like that. But anyway, there's a piece in the bill, I don't know if Jeremy really hit on it, though, that allows contractors and trying to remember if it came out in the dash ones now that I speak about it, but there's an amendment that allows the contractor to collect more than that if, in fact, they have costs of materials and permitting costs that are above that, and it allows them a percentage above that. Trying to remember, did that come out in our latest dash one amendment?
No, Mr. Chair. Actually, that was actually modified to allow the recovery of permitting costs in addition to materials and supplies.
Oh, it is in the dash one amendment. So I mean, it does give the contractor the ability to, you know, collect more than 50% down if they have, you know, costs that are, you know, over and above the 50% because of expensive taste or whatever, and gives them a percentage above those costs as well. So I was trying to be a little bit more lenient there. But my question is to you, I mean, the home builders have proposed something else. I don't know if you've had time to see what exactly they're talking about, where you would, and I'll get Scott up here in a minute, but just briefly, I think they're saying that you could put this kind of down payment requirements on contractors if they've had claim problems. And, you know, sounds good, but I'm just wondering about the logistics of CCB trying to do that and treat different contractors differently, you know, because they had a claim issue that maybe didn't go their way. And I just worry about, you know, having that kind of, treating contractors differently standard, and the pushback that may happen to that. Plus, I'm worried about whether CCB can handle that without increasing their budgetary needs.
Right. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I have talked with the home builders about a concept wherein we would expand the current law that allows for the contractors board to put contractors on probation. And there currently is a trigger that would allow for that kind of activity if a contractor has a certain number of complaints against their license. One could see, I can visualize expanding that in such a manner wherein it would trigger our ability to put that contractor on probation if he had taken a large down payment over 50%, let's say, and didn't diligently perform the contract, which really is the nature of the problem. You know, it really doesn't matter how much down payment is taken as long as the job gets done. The problem is, from time to time, unfortunately, once in a while, some contractors take that large down payment and then walk off with it. Sometimes it's a cash flow problem, sometimes it's something more than that. And if you chose to go, your policy decision really is, do you treat all the contractors the same and limit the ability to have a down payment? And I haven't been able to think all that out and tell if that's the best way to do it or not. But that certainly is one way to do it, and that's the way the Dash 1 amendments have been set up. Or do you go a different route and allow the just the bad contractors, when we get a complaint, it would be a complaint-driven process, to allow the contractors board to probably, in a very few cases, exercise this probationary authority. That's your policy debate.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the testimony, and I can see the committee is content with your testimony and doesn't have any questions whatsoever. So I'm going to call up Scott Berry, and who else was here to testify?
Brian
Krieg.
While they're coming, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kafori was also signed up, but I don't see him. If he's
He wasn't involved.
Okay. Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good evening. Good evening. Scott Berry, representing the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I will as well be brief.
I prefer good afternoon. My committee would not like the good evening.
All right, I will amend that to good afternoon. Members of the committee. Scott Berry, representing the Oregon Home Builders Association. I'll be brief. I think that part of the amendment that we're putting forward has already been discussed. I will say we did add a low threshold for it that allows the contractor's board to place those restrictions or put that contractor in this position if they fail to accept more than 50% and then fail to perform diligent manner of the work provided services required by the contract, or within 10 days of a reasonable demand for return of the deposit, fails to return that deposit amount. So it's a very low threshold. It happens one time. They're able to put that contractor on a deposit system, which would say that they could no longer accept those large down payments for the job. But we certainly run into scenarios where certain products, the actual work on a remodel or a small construction product, maybe about 20% of the cost, and 80% could certainly be the materials. And in those cases, we'd hate to have contractors who have, for their entire career, done a very good job of making sure their job gets done. They don't have complaint problems, and they don't want to jump through extra hoops to have to take the 80% down to go purchase the materials. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I believe the amendment will be ready tomorrow.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should have asked Craig this again. I've asked him this before, but I'll ask you, Scott. And I don't like to correct Craig because he does a good job, but he did refer to this as the pay twice. And from the perspective of the chair and Representative Riley and myself, since 07, we've paid far more than twice for this bill. But how big of a problem is it? It doesn't mean we shouldn't solve it, and doesn't mean I'm not worried about the consumer, but from your perspective, how big is the problem?
Chair Holby, Vice Chair Gilliam, it is not a large problem percentage-wise. It's a percent of 1% that we see in terms of folks who don't have a bond or insurance to cover those scenarios where this happens. It's very few. I mean, I the only numbers I have were, I believe, about 17 times per year from 2004, 2005, and 2006, for those 3 years. I don't have any more current numbers than those, and those are just off the top of my head, but I believe those are fairly accurate. Thank you.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, I haven't read this. Did we input the comment I made to you about the fact that the suppliers will issue the possibility of a lien so the consumer knows that he's got to work with it, be sure he's got a legitimate contractor and things like that? Now, we talked about how I've recently had a remodel where I had a notice of lien. I'd never had a notice of lien before. It scared the crap out of me, but then I didn't know that I'd already signed the paperwork, and so that was just another safe, fail-safe method to ensure that the consumer, if he's getting into these things, knows that he's could pay twice or have to.
Chair Holvey, Representative Wisnant, I know that the there are certainly notices already to the consumer that exist that allow that consumer to get the information about lien notices, and I think half the time, I would say more than half the time, most of the time, the lien notice, the notice of a right to lien, is what scares the consumer. It's rare that a lien actually gets perfected. But one thing we have talked about, and is not in this current bill, is a notification that would go also to the general contractor instead of just to the consumer on a notice of a right to lien, so that the general would then know that their subcontractor or a supplier working with a subcontractor has a right to lien that property down the road. That currently does not exist, and it does lead occasionally to confusion about or an understanding that or a lack of understanding that the general has that the consumer might be concerned about this. With something like that, the general, I think, could call the consumer up or communicate through a written form and inform them that that these are in some cases typical, and it does not mean there's a lien on the property. It's just securing the right of that sub or supplier to lien down the road if they're not paid.
Thank you. I have a couple more people to testify. I just want to comment on Representative Gilliam's a question to you about how big the problem is, and I don't know if we're talking about how big the pay-twice lien problem is. And certainly in a work group, we did have discussion about how big the problem was. Certainly if you base it on the claims that are made at CCB, it doesn't appear that big, but upon talking to many attorneys, there's not an extreme amount of documentation, and it does appear, perhaps from other states' experiences, that this problem is much bigger than what our claims show at the CCB, because attorneys sometimes handle these outside of that process. So, and sometimes people don't even take action on it. So the size of the problem, I think, has been underestimated largely in a lot of cases, and we found that with the assistance lien fund experience amongst other states running into solvency problems with their fund because they underestimated the size of the problem. Not going to argue with you about it, just want to make that statement. Having said that, got up next, Brian, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Brian Krieg. Today I'm representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, two of your larger subcontractor groups applying plumbing, HVAC systems, et cetera. We are supportive of the bill with the inclusion of the dash ones that Jeremy discussed with you a little earlier. We also think that the amendment that Scott and the home builders will be presenting, getting out tomorrow, would be an improvement on the bill in another way too, and would support its inclusion on there. I think that the issue with the down payment would be a lot easier for all of our contractors to deal with in making. You know, they're not going to have to make interesting judgment calls when they're dealing with a consumer and or the general. Like say they're trying to decide which air conditioning unit or heating unit they're going to put in. Do they want just the cheap one, or are they going to get the high efficiency one? We all hope they're going to get, going from a regular hot water tank to a tank. There's a fair amount of dollars that are different in there, and it can trigger some of the differences in the paperwork, and I think it might just be confusing at that level. And this, I think, actually, the way the home builders have written it, actually bring this down to a lot smaller contracts, too, that if you do something wrong in keeping the money and not getting the work done, you can get slapped for it. So basically, I think you have a bill here that's going to help the homeowners without hurting good licensed contractors, and I think that's our goal.
Thank you. I appreciate that and your testimony, and I hope I can call Craig Smith back up because I have a question that I need to ask him. Probably could ask him afterwards, but I might as well let you listen to the question as well.
Chair Holvey, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board.
So, Craig, I think I sort of alluded to this question previously, and I'm not sure if you answered me or maybe I just didn't hear the answer, and I was concerned about perhaps a fiscal impact to the home builder
proposal amendment. Do you, have you, I know I can't give you can't give me a guarantee that it's going to be this, this, or that, but do you see an increase in the cost to the CCB for implementing that piece of the bill?
Chair Holby, members of the committee, clearly the simple answer is there would be no increase that would cause some headaches for this bill. There would probably be a slight indication of cost to the agency, a cost of perhaps 10 to 20 additional enforcement actions per year. We currently take about 200 enforcement actions per month. So we're talking about 0.1%, and we could absorb that.
Thank you. I'm sure you're probably working on that right now anyway. So thank you for that. With that, committee, I appreciate your attention, and that wraps up the testimony on 3689. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3689. And committee, our next meeting is tomorrow. And we have public hearings posted, and I believe we will probably have a work session as well posted shortly.
Are we here on Friday?
We are not. Due to a popular demand of this committee, I lobbied to have our Friday committee move to Thursday.
What time, Mr. Chair?
I might even vote for a bill I don't want to now.
3:30. So with that, committee, I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability.
Can you open